G'day wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Light of the Prophets on Truth to You. That's truth number two, letteru.org, where you can sign up for the weekly newsletter and keep up to date via iTunes and Facebook and Twitter. And I'm Jono. Joining me is Yoel Ben Shlomo. G'day, Yoel.
Letteru too. I was supposed to do the intro. Jono has a cold. But I forced him to do it anyhow. He actually gave me the text, and I was about to read it, and I went like, "This is too small. I can't read this. I'm not going to read it as fast as usually as you do it. So I'm going to give it to you."
Yeah, so I did it. And yeah, I sound like I have a blocked nose. That's because I have a blocked nose. But exactly. I've got a cold. But we're powering through.
Yes, we are. We are. And this is the second attempt of recording this one. Last time my internet was causing a lot of trouble, which is also a reason why I can't actually. There was a plan on me doing a group lesson every Sunday, and my internet's not strong enough. But funny enough, the moment I released the email that says there's a problem, my landlord comes in and says, "Well, we should roll a wire together here because we both need the internet." I'm like, "Okay, let's do that." So what's that verse is. Ask and ye shall receive. So that's Amen. Kind of like what's going on here with this one. So thank God I'll probably be able to actually do the program anyhow. Mm. So today
As Keith always says, where there's a vision, there's provision.
And, exactly.
And that's what we have. So we're going to power through. We refuse to quit. And you know why? Because we're starting a new book. What is it?
We're starting a book. We're starting the book of Shmuel, Samuel. A very interesting book. Probably the most complex storyline we have in the entire Bible. We've done Joshua, which was a storyline, but when you look at it, it skips from battle to battle, and it goes from now we're dividing up the land, and then that last kind of a description of what was going on there before Joshua died, and then we had the book of Judges that gives us just these disjunctive stories one after the other, and the last two stories, the last story we actually have there is actually from an early stage, because they mentioned the name of one of Aaron's sons, Eleazar, who actually becomes the high priest. So we know the stories from a very early stage, and kind of shows a bit of what happened there with the corruption. It was very, very fast, and this is where this is why Moses created, you know, essentially, if you look at the book of Deuteronomy is Moses giving his last speech before he dies. He knew what was going to happen. He realized that no matter what happens, something is going to go wrong eventually, and it happens all the time. You have a great leader, and unless his successor is any good, and he carries on the message that was given by the original leader, it's not going to survive. And this is the whole point of the book of Samuel. You know, we called this program Light of the Prophets, and this is where the light actually begins. This is where organization comes into play. But we do have to remember something very, very simple. And I think everyone who listens to this program, at least most people, have read the book of Samuel. I know it's a story, so it's a bit easier to read sometimes. And the thing that we notice is that there is a struggle in this story. There's a struggle of leadership. There's a struggle. Mm-hmm. We see the struggle in the beginning of the book already. Not in the first, another chapters we're going to be dealing with today, but from chapter 3, there's a struggle of leadership. Similar struggle happens afterwards with David and Saul. And David has his struggle throughout his entire life with leaders, other people who are aspiring to become king, and people from the house of Saul that try to get rid of him. And the storyline itself is very, very interesting. And we learn a lot of things just from the characters here. I mean, we have three leaders. So we start off with the leader in the story we're going to deal with today, which is Eli or Eli.
I was talking to someone named Eli just earlier today, a rabbi. What is the meaning of that name?
So were you talking to a man called Eli, maybe?
Mm-hmm.
There are two names very similar. One is Eli with a guttural A in the beginning, known as Ein. And then there's Eli, which is an abbreviation of Eliyahu, which is Elijah. Okay. What is the etymology of the name Eli? I actually never really sat down to look at that one, I have to admit. But it's funny you bring up the issue of names, because I actually posted on Facebook something about people picking out these names. And I keep on bumping into some names that are not really names, they're just nouns. Or sometimes adjectives.
Yes. and or verbs as well. Some people that have taken on Hebrew names that actually belong to the opposite sex.
Exactly. We have that as well. I mean, there was this wonderful lady. I don't think she listens to the programs, but she's a friend of mine. and she picked out the name Yitra. And Yitra is a man's name. We actually have a man called Yitra who's mentioned either as Yitra the Israelite or Yitra the Ishmaelite, and there's a bit of a discussion about why is he named twice. And when we go to the end of the book of Samuel, we also have this whole issue of names which appear there, and there's a few interesting things that were discovered by comparing these names, and some names are doubled. For example, you go in the book of Chronicles, you have a similar list, but the names are different. They're actually slightly different. And this probably presents, again, if you take Samuel and you take Chronicles, you know, the two different traditions maybe, and this is where sometimes stories are contradicting, but it's not really something we have to really worry about. I would be more concerned if I found a contradiction in the Torah. You know, that would make my that will cause
that'd
some trouble.
That'd make your hair stand up.
When you find contradictions in these books, it's nothing to really worry about. It could be two different storylines or two different traditions, and someone made sure that, you know, this story survives and this story survives, and we don't have any trouble with forgetting things. Another very important thing is that Book of Samuel is actually the next book after the Book of Judges. In some Bibles, it appears as the Book of Ruth is the next book. It doesn't show up like this. This is actually an interesting. This is an interesting thing.
So I was just going to say, it's actually that originally Samuel Shmuel is one book. I believe it was divided into two by the writers of the Septuagint, but originally but
we
one.
And we also have the issue that the book of the next book in the Hebrew Bible is Samuel, not the Book of Ruth. If I remember correctly, I think you point out to me one of the conversations we had.
Yeah, that's right. And because I mentioned, I think, that now Ruth is traditional to read during Shavuot. So we made a promise to the listeners that we're going to do that when we come around to Shavuot. Next time, we will go through the Book of Ruth.
Yes, we'll try to do that as well. So yeah, as you notice, I'm taking over the show because Jono's kind of sick. Doesn't have too much of a voice. So we're going to try to go through this almost solo, not exactly, but almost.
No, I'll still do my best to interrupt you every now and then.
Yeah. I need your questions. Your questions always help with the you'll be surprised that sometimes the discussions that you and I have cause me to think about other ideas, and I noticed in the beginning, I actually listen to my own recordings and I take notes to myself of things I thought of while recording. So it's pretty.
Exactly the same thing happens to me because, of course, I listen back to them at least twice. And each time I'm like, oh, there's something I didn't even think of when you were saying, when I was saying, whatever. And I know that happens with the listeners as well. So we may as well kick off because here we are. This is what it says. It starts like this. Now, there was a certain man of Ramataim. Now, we've already spoken about Rama in the final chapters of Judges. Is this the same place?
It could be. But the thing is, the name Rama, again, the word Ram in general in Hebrew means a high place or an elevated space. It's not a Bama. Okay, let's make sure.
And so this is a plural, so this is, you know, high places.
This is a dual. They're the Ramatayim, the two Ramot. So it might have been one place divided on two hills, for example, or two places they called Rama, and there was two places which were named after that. I mean, for example, today there's a place in Jerusalem called Ramot. There's a northern neighborhood called Ramot. And the reason they call it Ramot is they assume that that might have been the area of the original Rama. Yeah, this is a place called Ramatayim. So the I'm ending is a dual. And then it's a very interesting thing. This is very rare that it happens, but it mentions the exact location of the place and then the exact name of the person. So you carry on reading.
Yeah, Ramatayim Zophim of the mountains of Ephraim. His name was Elkanah, the son of Yeroham, the son of Elihu. Now, this is the difference. There's Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zuf, an Ephraimite, and he had two wives. Well, what do we do about that? That doesn't work today.
So first of all, Zophim, what you read, Zophim is actually a land of Tzuf. And we bump into land of Tzuf again at one point. Now, he had two wives. Yes, he had two wives. And I know, I unfortunately never go around to actually listen to it, but I did hear that my very good friend Nehemiah went into this whole thing about polygamy and explained it. So let me explain something very, very simple. First of all, polygamy is not something anyone strives for, to be very clear. Because, you know, first of all, I actually know someone who has two wives.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very unusual thing. It's not practiced in the Jewish. It's actually been banned in the Jewish world. And I know that it's very rough for them. They're always struggling with one another. So it's not an ideal thing. Mm. But I have to disagree here. I think polygamy is allowed. And we have many cases of polygamy in the Bible. And there's no actual clear prohibition of polygamy because, you know, when it says achota litzror, some people want to say that it's literally her, some want to say it means literally her sister. We're talking going back into Leviticus. So litzror, also from the word tzara, which means a rivalry. And some people explain that the word achot means doesn't mean literally a sister, but means any other woman. Because sometimes, you know, I can call you my brother, and I can call someone else my sister. And we're not talking literally about real brothers and sisters, but the unity in between the two people. So we need to put two people together like brothers and sisters. But here in this, specifically in this case, because of the terminology used here, where it's talking about direct relatives, I think it's simpler because in the verse before it talks about mother and daughter, or either the verse before or after, I think it's actually easier to explain that it means actual sisters. There were also people keep on asking about, well, about Jacob. Well, again, I don't have this problem because I don't believe the Torah was actually given before Mount Sinai. So I don't think there was an actual issue. And I know there might be a whole bunch of people saying, oh, how do you explain this? How do you explain that? When you look at the ancient world, you can look at it from two perspectives. You can say the knowledge of the Torah was known before, and this is why different nations had different information which resembles the Torah. Or that God worked inside a criteria of a world that was familiar to the Israelites. You can approach it from both ends, and both are reasonable.
That's a good way to put it. Both are reasonable. Yeah,
both are reasonable.
Yeah, both are plausible, right? Both are plausible.
Yeah. And but when you look specifically at this subject, when you look around the world, you never see a prohibition of marrying two wives. You only see a prohibition of incest. You never see a prohibition of marrying two wives. You only see a prohibition of marrying relatives. Sure. And there was even I think in the Hittite law, was it Hittite or Amorite law? One of them. Says that you're not allowed to marry even your cousins. And what's interesting, Ethiopians that come to Israel, they have a rough time because they have to remember genealogies back several generations to make sure they don't marry certain relatives. So they don't marry cousins either. But I will point out that the whole discussion about was the Torah known before or after has to do with the discussion of from the Second Temple period. There were Jewish groups who were arguing that certain pieces of information were known before were given to these characters because they were trying to argue that the knowledge they have dates back even before Moses to legitimize themselves. So when someone walks up with this idea of saying, you know, I believe that the Torah was known before, you should research this a bit more because you'll be surprised what you'll discover. I've looked at this a couple of times, and it looks as if this really is more of an apologetic argument with the rabbinic Judaism, with the Pharisees, than anything else. We're trying to say that our knowledge is older, and this is a classic thing that was done in the ancient world. The older you are, the better. And this is something I've been dealing with also because people started saying, well, if it's older, it's obviously better. And it's not necessarily like that. I've worked, for example, with manuscripts a bit of the Talmud, and I've discovered that not all older manuscripts are better. Some manuscripts are actually a lot more corrupt than others, and they're the older ones. So it's not that simple. It is not that simple to say that I found something old, therefore it's better. It's something one has to keep in mind.
Before we go any further, I just want to take the opportunity to say g'day to one of the Halevi princes that I can hear in the background. Which Halevi prince is this?
So this is Junior. This is
Halevi the Fourth.
This is Halevi the Fourth, also known as Yehonatan, which is Jonathan.
That's a great name.
Yeah, he's actually about to go to sleep for his
late morning
nap.
No, he sounds so cute there in the background, but I had to introduce him because he is sounding so cute. But in any case, that's the complexity of the argument, and it does go back and forth. But in any case, he did have two wives, and one the name of one was Hannah. And the name of the other was Peninnah.
So let's just go over here a couple of things. So just very quickly. So it does seem that he married Peninnah. I mean, I'm assuming here that he married Peninnah because Hannah was barren. So mm-hmm. it kind of explains that, you know, you yeah. don't marry your second wife unless there's a good reason for it. And I looked into practices, for example, of the Jerusalem Jews who lived under the Ottomans, and they never married a second wife unless, and this is as far as I know, unless the first wife couldn't bear children.
Mm.
And they waited 10 years, and if there were no children after 10 years, then they will marry a second wife.
Mm-hmm.
So she didn't have any children. Now, Chana, by the way, if you look at the name Chana, Chana, first of all, didn't your wife take the name Chana?
Chani, yeah, Chani is Chana. A form of Chana, that's right. And it means gracious or grace, right? Comes from
so Chana is the feminine form of Chanan, or Yohanan, or Yehochanan. And Chana is the same idea. The root is the same. It's the same root, Chanan. There's a dagesh in the Nun. Makes mm-hmm. it Chet Nun. So it's actually the feminine form of Yohanan. So if anyone's called Janice, for example, or Jane, or anything like that, she can actually call herself Chana.
Yeah.
Penina is pearl. It's the Penina in Hebrew is also a noun which means a pearl. So her name is Pearl. And I think she's the only character in the entire Bible called Pearl, by the way.
There you go.
And I did wonder
if the English penny came from there.
The English penny might come from that as well.
Perhaps.
It might be.
Yeah. Well, in any case, Penina had children. Chana had no children. And this man, now who is he again? We're referring to Elkanah, right?
Yeah, so Va'ala Ha'ish. So it uses the word Ha'ish. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mention him at all. But we obviously know it's Elkanah because it's the man. It's not just a man. It's the man.
The man. The man went up from his city.
By the way, this is called anaphoric use. This is an anaphoric use where we hint backwards to something without actually mentioning it.
Mm, okay. And he went to the city yearly to worship and sacrifice Jehovah of hosts in Shiloh. Shiloh. Now, this is where we are, right? Now, again, we made reference to this in the closing. Oh, because we were talking about the feast where the Benjamites would go and steal the wives from and so on and so forth during the feast, blah, blah, blah. And
exactly. So by the way, regarding Shiloh, I actually have a video I filmed with my phone when I went to Shiloh with Keith. Where I actually went down into the platform where they think the tabernacle stood and actually filmed every section there. And it's a 6-minute video. And I need just to edit it a bit and then I can actually put it on Facebook and minimize it a bit as well.
Look forward to seeing that. And also the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Pinchas, the priests of Jehovah, were there.
Yeah, so Hophni, he might be from the root of Chafan. Now, Chafan is to... ball your hand and pick something up. And that this might be a hint to the behavior that we read later on about them in chapter 3. And then Pinchas is Pinchas Phinehas. It's the same name. There, Pinchas was one of the children of Aaron.
Mm-hmm.
One of the grandchildren, wasn't he? Grandchild of Aaron.
The son of Eleazar.
Eleazar, yeah. He was the grandson of Aaron. So it's mm-hmm. a name that probably ran in the family.
And so I've got, by the way, just in my study notes here, I've got Hophni means tadpole.
Tadpole?
Yeah, like a frog's, like a tadpole.
I don't know about that. I mean, I can run over my books and look if you want.
I'm just saying that's what it's got. And it says Pinchas comes from an Egyptian word meaning black one. Does that sound familiar to you?
That actually sounds familiar. That does sound familiar. Yeah, so yeah, Pinchas, I mean, again, you have to remember they came out of Egypt. I mean, even the name Aaron, I have a son called Aaron. And it's kind of funny because we're called Halevi, and there's actually a verse in Exodus that says, "Halo Aharon Achicha Halevi." And so we play a joke on that one, that my son's name appears in the Torah with the first name, the last name as well. And so even the name Aharon, some people speculate Aharon, Moshe. Some people speculate these are actually Egyptian names.
Mm. Yeah, I've heard speculation about that. So anyhow, that's interesting. And it says, whenever the time came for Elkanah to make an offering, he would give portions to Peninnah, his wife, and to all her sons and daughters. But to Chanah, he would give a double portion, for he loved Chanah, although Yehovah had closed her womb. So it says Yehovah had closed her womb. And it just, I suppose that reiterates the fact that Yehovah gives children, that the children mm-hmm. are a gift from him. And mm-hmm. and then it refers in verse 6, it says, and her rival. So it refers to Peninnah as the rival of Chana, in my English at least, as rival and provoked her severely.
Yeah, so he actually uses the word tsarata, her rival, her tsara, which means her the second wife.
Uh-huh.
So it's using the same term we found in Leviticus.
Yeah, which is interesting.
So there's actually a bit of a debate here. What exactly was Penina's purpose in what she was doing? Was she trying to make? Was she really teasing her, being a mean person, or was she trying to provoke her to pray?
Well, I don't know. But what I've got in the English, it says provoked her severely to make her miserable because Yehovah had closed her womb.
So it says here, ba'avu hara'ima. So first of all, there's an interesting thing here. The word hara'ima, the resh has a dagesh, which is kind of it's a special thing, but besides the point. For those who know Hebrew, understand what I mean. So some people, you know, hara'ima actually sounds like, you know, first of all, root is ra'am, which is a thunder to make a noise. Uh-huh. And some people read, this meaning that to make her angry, to tease her, to cause her to suffer. And some people say, no, tara'omit, to go and complain. That she actually were in Shiloh, I want to make her go and complain in the temple to God, why don't I have children?
So that is an interesting way of looking at it. I wouldn't have thought to look at it that way. And the reason why is because of the prayer that we're going to get to, actually the poem that Hannah's prayer in chapter 2. So let's revisit that when we get there, because that is interesting. But it says, so it was year by year when she went up, Yoel, they all went up to the house of Yehovah, that she provoked her there, for she wept and did not eat. So I guess she fasted. It sounds like she was depressed, really.
Obviously depressed. I mean, I've met people who don't have children, and when they see children, they can see the sadness in their eyes. So
when they want children, they have difficulty in conceiving. Then yeah, it can be a very, very difficult thing, and this is what she was going through. But it says, now this is beautiful though. Then Elkanah, her husband, said to her, Hannah, why do you weep? Why do you not eat? And why is your heart grieved? Am I not better to you than 10 sons?
By the way, I just noticed something, a reason to believe that the second opinion I said was correct, because it says here that she made her angry to cause her to complain, and then it says for the Lord has closed her womb. I think that's the reason why people say that it means that to make her pray, because it gives a causal clause afterwards saying because, for it has happened. So this is probably it. She's not being mean. She's trying to cause her to pray. She's saying, you know, the solution is pray. You know, go down on your knees and pray. You know,
sure,
because it repeats this concept of God has closed her womb twice, because it says here he gave her a double portion because he loved her, for the Lord has closed her womb, and then it repeats immediately the next verse. It repeats it at the end of that verse as well. So there's an issue here pointing that out. You don't repeat something twice unless there's a reason.
Fair enough.
I think that's the reason why they say that.
And so, but I find that beautiful that Elkanah says to her, "Am I not better to you than 10 sons?" And so he's being positive about the situation. He's being optimistic. He's looking on the bright side, and he's trying to encourage her and pick her up. I think, and I think that's nice.
But yeah, Hannah, that's what husbands should do.
That's what they should do. But we're not always that bright, are we? This guy sounds pretty good. So no,
he seems to be the perfect husband.
He's the perfect husband. But she arose after they had finished eating and drinking in Shiloh. Now Eli the priest. Now before I go any further, okay, Eli the priest. If we go, now correct me if I'm wrong, but I think now that Eli was from, where was he from? I got to get this right. Didn't I read somewhere, was it in Chronicles that he was from Itamar?
What do you mean? He was from the family of Itamar?
Yeah.
Right. It might be. I mean, if we want to figure out what his family was, I mean, we have to look into the Chronicles of the families.
Let me just have a look here, because I thought I read, and I've just got to look it up, and it says, this is Pinchas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, stood before it in those days, saying, shall I yet again go out to battle against the children? Okay, so that's in Judges, and obviously, you know, not long ago in Judges, we had, as you mentioned before, Aaron, Eleazar, Pinchas. Now we've got Eli, the priest, who's sitting on the seat at the doorpost of the tabernacle of Yehovah.
But really, the doorpost is very important. What it actually hints to us is that there was a doorpost, which means, and it uses the word mezuzah. So there's a tradition in the rabbinic writings that the tabernacle in Shiloh wasn't a tent anymore. It wasn't at least the structure which was used in the desert. It was actually a roofless structure made out of rock.
Mm-hmm.
And it had doors, and it mentions later on these doors that Samuel opens. And the roof, only the roof was really part of the original tabernacle, and the rest was actually a stone structure.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So I'm just trying to establish what it was that I've said. And
so I'm looking here in Chronicles 5, and Eli's not mentioned as being part of the descendants of Eleazar. So it could be, you're right, he might be a descendant of Itamar.
I think he is. I think he's a descendant of Itamar, which is just an interesting thing, because how did the priesthood pass to him? How is it that we've arrived here is the question.
Yeah, tell the truth, I do not know the answer, but
I've
have
got no idea.
In Chronicles 5, verse 29, it says, "And the sons of Amram, Aaron, and Moshe, and Miriam, sons of Aaron, Nadav, Avihu, Eleazar, and Itamar. Eleazar gave birth to Pinchas. Pinchas gave birth to Avishua." It wasn't gave birth, I mean, descendant. So it's Pinchas, Avishua, Buki, Uzi, Zerachia, Mariot, Amaria, Achituv, then Tzadok. So this is part of the issue. Part of the things that happens in the book of Samuel is the fall of one leadership and the rise of another. And in the book of Samuel, there's the fall of the house of Eli and the rise of the house of Tzadok.
Mm-hmm.
There's the fall of the house of Samuel and the rise of the house of Saul, and then the fall of the house of Saul and the rise of the house of David.
David, yeah.
And we have this. So Tzadok, Achimatz, Azariah, Yochanan, Azariah. And it says him, Azariah was the priest, which was the priest in the house that King Solomon built. Azariah, Maria, Achituv. So there's his whole names repeating. Achituv, Tzadok, Shalom, Chilkiah, Azariah, Sraya, Yehotzadak. And Yehotzadak was exiled by Nebuchadnezzar. So we don't see the name of Eli here. So it could be Eli was really a descendant of Itamar, which raises a big question, but it wasn't given to Eleazar. And it might be that it was taken away. Might have been that there was some struggle in between them.
Possibly. I like you, I really don't know. It'd be interesting if any listeners have comments in regards to that. We would love to hear it. So certainly leave comments in regards if you have a theory there. But that's just a curious thing of verse 9. And she was a bitterness of soul, Yoel, and prayed to Yehovah and wept in anguish. And she made a vow and said, "O Yehovah of hosts, if you will indeed look in the affliction of your maidservant and remember me and not forget your maidservant, but will give your maidservant a male child, then I will give him to Yehovah all the days of his life, and no razor shall come upon his head." No razor shall come upon his head. We've spoken about that. We've spoken about this.
So some people say that Samuel was also a Nazarite.
Mm-hmm.
So he wasn't just he wasn't only. So there's an interesting discussion. I have a friend. I have several friends who are Nazarites. They mm-hmm. took, and I say Nazarites, I mean took the oath of the Nazir, not Nazareans or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
People who took the oath of the Nazir. They don't shave their heads. They don't come in contact with the dead and everything. And one of them asked
me,
they don't drink wine. Yeah, don't eat grapes. Don't drink wine. I even almost had an incident with one of them. I had loaves of bread at home, and there were sourdough, but the sourdough was based on grape juice, and I almost gave it to him, and I was very embarrassed. I was like, "Oops, sorry!" I almost snatched it out of his hand. One of them asked me a question. He says, "So, what's the purpose of the Nazarite?" And it happens to be, I don't think there's any word in Hebrew is mikre. What's the word in English for it? Everything happens for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
There's no coincidence in the world. Mm-hmm. So I just finished reading a very interesting book, almost done. Interesting book about the book of Leviticus, and there's a bunch of little interesting things. And he talks about the issue of the Nazarite, and talks about the issue of the holiness of becoming a Nazarite. And he points out the Nazarite becomes kind of like a priest. So it could be that what was going on here is he said, well, if he's going to be living in the temple, he has to be like the priest. And okay, so he becomes a Nazarite. She actually created a Nazarite oath for her son, and this was part of the agreement. And there's even in the Talmudic tradition, it mentions that if a person says that he takes a vow not to shave his head, what he's really saying is that he's taking a vow to become a Nazarite.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Nazirite is kind of like a priest. And this would explain a couple of things about what was going on here with Samuel.
So what I have heard is that there is a higher level of being separated unto God, if I can say that, a higher level. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's a better way to put it, but that seems to be what she's saying. And so, and it happened, verse 12, as she continued praying before Yehovah, that Eli watched her mouth. Nachana spoke in her heart, only her lips moved. So she's talking in her head, but she's moving her lips. I know people that do that. And
in Judaism, this is what we do. We actually learn the practice. If you ever look at how prayer is done in a synagogue, an Orthodox one, what's done is there's a silent prayer.
Mm.
And you move your lips, but you don't really vocalize the words. Mm. Mm. And we learn it from this, but this was unusual. In the ancient world, people would scream on top of their voice if they have anything they want to say.
Sure.
And so he's standing there. Eli's sitting there on his chair, it seems. And, he's sitting on his chair next to the doorpost of Heichal Hashem. So it's the first time we see this word Heichal. Mm-hmm. And the word Heichal, we find the word Heichal in Sumerian, which is a galu, I think the word is. And in Akkadian, it's Hechalu, it's very similar to Hechal, and Hechal means a large house,
mm-hmm.
or a large structure, almost like a large room. So this is the first time we see the house of God being called the large room of God, the large house of God.
Right.
So it kind of also hints to the idea this was an actual structure, this is no longer a tent.
Huh. Interesting.
So the other thing is that she's close enough, I mean, he's an old man,
mm-hmm.
and I mean, he dies at the age of 98. But this is just a couple of years before he dies. So his vision's already going. Mm-hmm. But she was close enough for him to see her mumbling,
mm-hmm.
which means she was probably very close to the altar. Now, if anyone's ever studied at least Second Temple Judaism, people were not allowed to come close to the altar.
Mm-hmm.
You were allowed to walk up to a certain point. But here she was standing in some place that enabled him to see her. And she was probably very close to the altar. Now, in Second Temple period,
what you're suggesting is if there was a second court around about, she was obviously allowed to be there.
Exactly. Now, if you go to the tabernacle in Shiloh, you don't really. There's like these two platforms there,
mm-hmm.
and they're both more or less the same size. And I looked at both and was trying to decide which one was the one that was used. And when I went around both of them, looked around, I came to the conclusion that it's probably the one to the west. But mm-hmm. it looks as if there were like two courts, or maybe one was actually housing and the other one was the actual tabernacle area. But it seems as if there was like a surrounding area, there was some kind of like two courts there. But she was standing next to the altar. Now, in Second Temple period, women were not even allowed to go into the court that surrounds mm-hmm. the area of the altar. And here we see the exact opposite. So this actually probably has to do with a Sadducee development where they were trying to keep people away from the temple. And, you know, the less contamination by the commoners, the better. And this is what the Sadducees were doing. Well, the Pharisees were going like, no, the temple is for the nation. The temple is open for everyone. Mm-hmm. People are now not allowed to go on the altar if they're not priests, and not allowed to go into the temple itself. But in the surrounding court, there's no reason why they couldn't go into the surrounding court. So there's actually the whole, you know, segregation actually came from the Sadducees and not from the Pharisees, like some people want to say.
Interesting.
I actually read a whole book about the Sadducees, and you can see that part of their mentality. I need a moment. I have to put the baby to sleep. So
don't pull him. What is he? What is
no,
he
no. He will be grumpy. He will be very, very
okay.
grumpy.
To sleep. All right.
So just a second.
Okay.
Okay, I'm back.
Cool. Okay. So.
So where were we?
Well, and it happened as she continued. Now he's looking at her and he's thinking, oh well, you must be drunk because you're babbling away, but I can't hear you, so you're not in your right mind. You're probably drunk. And he said to her, so how long will you be drunk? Put away your wine. Put it away from you. But Hannah answered and said, no, my Lord, I am a woman of sorrowful spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor intoxicating drink, but have poured out my soul before Yehovah. Do not kill it. Now, Yoel, do not consider your maidservant a wicked woman. What do you have in the Hebrew?
So it says, Al titen, do not give or put et amatcha, your female servant, lifnei bat belial. So before, it's a, if you mechanically translate, it says before bat belial, why does he choose the word lifnei is an interesting thing, but it probably means do not put me as if I'm a bat Belial. Because usually it's usually we've seen bnei Belial. Here it's a bat Belial, it's single, and it's also feminine. So bat is daughter. Or girl. So it's daughter or a woman who's Belial. And lifnei, you know, some people might say, oh, she's before. But this is how this. Sometimes when you read certain words in the Bible in Hebrew, the context is what gives away the meaning. Because lifnei means before. But what she's really saying is, don't make me look as if I'm. Don't accuse me of being a bat Belial.
Don't accuse me as, and we've spoken about that word before, Belial, as someone who is without yoke or someone who is unrestrained, I suppose. And so someone who would consume a lot of alcohol without stopping, particularly at a feast or whatever it may be, someone who is unrestrained. And she goes on to say, for out of the abundance of my complaints and grief, I have spoken until now. Then he answered and said, go in peace, and the God of Israel grant your petition which you have asked of him. And she said, let your maidservant find favor in your sight. So the woman went away and ate, and her face was no longer sad. Good on him.
So yeah, so he basically came to her, you know, he's a priest, and his job is to supervise in the temple.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're in a position of authority and you've seen someone who looks if they're misbehaving, you do have to deal with a firm hand. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, for example, you go to the Western Wall. And you do have the occasional tourist who doesn't fully understand this is a holy site. You know, you have people who try to walk in with women try to walk in with really, really, really short pants, or or men that try to walk in with sleeveless shirts and stuff like that. And there are these authorities there, these people who work in the Western Wall that, you know, tell them to cover up.
Mm-hmm.
Also in the Temple Mount, the same thing. First of all, there's signs that say, you know, please, you know, you're entering a holy site, please cover up, make sure you're dressed modestly. Mm-hmm. And in those places, there's a firm hand there about the subject. So the same thing here. He's in a temple. He's in charge of the temple. This is a temple. This is not just a tent. And so
he's there to enforce proper protocol, right?
Yeah, he's there to enforce proper. So in the beginning, he's kind of harsh with her. Right? He thinks she's drunk.
Mm.
And you know, the priests are not allowed to enter the temple drunk. They're allowed to serve drunk, and I think drunk people were not allowed into the temple itself as well. Basically, he was using a firm hand. There was a whole issue in the temple of protecting the temple from unclean things. And this is a woman; she's drunk. You don't even know what she's doing. When you're looking at her, she's sitting there. She's, you know, in a culture where people, when they prayed, they would raise their hands, yell out, or say something out loud, whatever it would be. And here's this woman, probably down on her knees. Hands on her, folded in everything, and she's mumbling to herself. And you're as a priest, you look at that, and it's your job. You're commanded to make sure that the temple's never harmed. So obviously, you're gonna use a slightly, when you're authority, you put your foot down. But when she explains it, he softens up. So he's not being mean to her. So I mean, I remember when I was reading this as a child. I mean, we learned the Book of Samuel was like in the fifth grade or something. And I remember reading, I said, why is he so mean to her? Why is he, look what's going on with her. But you see that he's being a true leader. He's using a tactic. He's being firm about what has to be done, but he's not being rude. But when he's told what the truth is, then he calms down. He goes, oh, okay, fine. It's okay. Don't worry.
Yeah. And he wishes her well. I mean, he says, go in peace, and may the God of Israel grant your petition, which you have asked him. And I think that's beautiful. And she went away encouraged. She's no longer sad. Her face was lifted, and it says in 19, and then they arose the next early in the morning and worshipped before Yehovah, and returned and came to the house of Ramah. And Elkanah knew his wife Hannah, and Yehovah remembered her. So it came to pass in the process of time that Hannah conceived and bore a son, and called his name Shmuel. Now, saying, because I have asked for him from Yehovah. Now, it's a funny thing, Yoel. In my study notes, in my New King James study notes, I have two different, believe it or not, on the same page, I have two different definitions for the name. In one little note here, it says literally heard by God. In another, it says Shmuel means, which means name of God. Which one is correct?
So actually, we usually explain this a bit differently.
Yeah.
The way we study this is, what were the two definitions? Name of God and?
And heard by God.
heard by God. So actually, some people say that this has to do with, because she starts saying here, we're in Hebrew, "Vatikra et Shemo," and she called his name Shemuel, "Ki me'Adonai she'altiv." So this is not necessarily literally borrowed from another word. It's using a sound of the she'a, Shemu. It's playing with these sounds. So really, Shemuel probably means borrowed from God.
Really?
Because she gives the meaning of the name. Why is she calling him Shemuel? For he is Shaul from God.
Ah,
Shaul by that's soul as well. It's kind of funny.
That's interesting because I figured if it was Shemuel, then the name of God, Shemuel. But it's Shmuel, and that's interesting, particularly when we get to verse 28, that kind of elaborates on that. So we're gonna get there. But
and there's actually another little perk I want to give you. So there's a game here with Sha'al, Shmuel, and Shiloh.
Oh, truly?
Yeah, there's things you miss out when you deal with the English. So there's an interesting one of the commentators I was going through when I was preparing this was he goes over this whole thing of like, notice the sound, that there's the same sounds. Shmuel, Shiloh, Shmuel, and Sha'al, or She'altiv, and it's just an interesting game there.
Sha'al, remind me, what is Sha'al?
Sha'al is to request or to ask.
Ah, right. Sha'al, Shmuel, and Shi'or.
Shiloh.
Okay, beautiful.
Sha'al, Shmuel, Shiloh.
Thank you,
it's a little word game here.
Sure.
There's a lot more going. To tell you the truth, if we actually sit down and analyze this a narrative level and a textual level, there's a lot more going on here. You asked me to limit it, but there's a lot I can say.
I know, because I've got a cold. Sorry, people. I have a cold. Now, it says, the man Elkanah and all his house went up to offer to Jehovah yearly as a yearly sacrifice and his vow, but Hannah did not go, for she said to her husband, this is her revealing her vow to her husband, not until the child is weaned, then I will take him, that he may appear before Jehovah and remain there forever. That's really interesting to me, Yoel. I'll tell you why. Because when we go back to the conversation that she had, the prayer, the vow that she actually made before she spoke to Eli, the priest, it says in verse 11, she made a vow. She said, "O Yehovah of hosts, if you will indeed look upon the affliction of your maidservant, remember me and do not forget your maidservant, but you will give your maidservant a male child, then I will give him to Yehovah all the days of his life," and so on and so forth. But here she says, "Not until he is weaned," and obviously that's just common sense. It's not as if she's going back on her vow. This is a perfect example of reasonable common sense. Of course she's going to wean the boy. Of course she's going to wean him before she takes him to the temple, right?
Yeah, but I think people are a lot more literal than it was literal. The moment he's taken, she treated it like that. She's being very, very literal about things. And she says, if he's born, I give him to God. The moment he's in the presence of God, that's it. He's taken away. That's how she was looking at it.
Do you think so? Do you think she changed her mind? Because
No. She didn't change her mind. She wanted to be his mother.
Mm.
She wanted to be able to raise him to a point where he's no longer completely dependent on his mother. He's not breastfeeding anymore.
Yeah.
But she says, you know, when you promise something to God, you're supposed to bring it to the temple. You're supposed to bring it to God himself, and not himself, but the place where his name dwells. And the moment you put it there, that's it. You're done. This is probably the mindset that we're in. So this is why she was being very, very careful. Yes, I agree. In our mindset, you know, we look at it and we say, well, you know, but she's going to give him anyhow. So, you know, just give him a short while. But it's probably the same way they treated, for example, first fruits and stuff like that. The moment you put it in the temple, that's it. You can't take it back and say, I'll bring it back in a week. You can't do that. Mm. So she's looking at this. Remember, he's a firstborn, so he's like a first fruit ish.
That's fair enough. That's true.
That's probably what's going on here. And they were looking, probably analyzing things based on other things that were practiced in their world. And it could be that in the ancient world as well, the moment you bring the offering or you bring the child to serve in the temple, that's it. You never take him back.
Mm. And so obviously she hasn't gone to the temple until he is weaned. And it doesn't say how old he is, but from what I've read, the general consensus seems to be he was probably three, certainly maybe no more than four.
So it says here, it says here that she went into adigamel. Adigamel means to be done with breastfeeding.
Mm-hmm.
And the consensus is that breastfeeding in the ancient world was in between 2 to 3 years. So here's a personal story. I breastfed for 3 years.
Yeah, so did my boy William.
Yeah, and it's actually here in Israel is considered to be unusual because most people breastfeed to like 2-ish. And in the U.S., most people don't even breastfeed.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was a child, I mean, I actually have the two funny stories about me. Everything was at least one something extra. As a child, I was born almost at 10th month.
Oh, really? You were overcooked.
I was too big. I was the doctor said, you know, my mother's like in the 43rd, 44th. There's what's going on here? You know, get out. And my mother goes to the doctor and says, listen, we're going to give him another turn, like a week or something. If he doesn't get out, we're going to pull him out. And I wasn't born very heavy, but I was born relatively big for my uh-huh. age.
For your age, which was zero.
I actually have a friend who was born 6 kilos, and he's not a very big guy. But I was born a reasonable weight, but so everything about me was always an extra one. So it was almost 10 months, and then it was almost 3 years. I mean, my mother basically turned around to me and said, okay, honey, listen, I'm pregnant again. Knock it off.
But it was not unusual. I mean, it's really not that unusual. If people allow their children to breastfeed maybe for longer, then maybe more people would be weaned at three. But William, our youngest, he weaned at three. You weaned at three. It's not unheard of.
Yeah, but by the way, that's why I'm so smart.
Yeah, that's what it is. Yeah.
No, I'm telling you, seriously, I actually once read a research, now I'm being serious. I actually once read a research that children who breastfeed more are actually smarter.
Yeah, well, I breastfed for 6 months, so knock it off. So, Elkanah...
Well, that explains a lot. Okay.
Her husband said to her, do what seems best to you. So he heard the vow, and he was like, okay, so I've heard what you've said. You're going to take him when he's weaned. That's fine. So he's... Because, of course, he has the power to say, no, you know, according to the Torah, he has the power to write off a vow, right? But he doesn't do that.
But he didn't do it. He has 24 hours to write off the vow.
From when he hears it, right?
When he hears it, and he probably heard it.
Yeah, perhaps. We don't know. I mean, if this is the first time.
She's probably reminding him more perhaps. Than anything. She's reminding him.
Do what seems best to you and wait till you've weaned him. Only let Yehovah establish his word. And, of course, that's important. So then the woman stayed and nursed her son until she had weaned him. Now, when she'd weaned him, she took him up with her with 3 bulls, 1 ephah of flour, a skin of wine, and brought him to the house of Yehovah in Shiloh. And the child was young. And that's all we know. So 2 or 3, perhaps.
It says, V'hana'ar na'ar. The young boy is a young boy. He's a little boy. He's a boy chick. He's not. He's a child. He's a very chick. Small child.
Like a little halabi. And then they slaughtered a bull and brought the child to Eli. And she said, my Lord, as your soul lives, my Lord, I am the woman who stood by you here praying to Yehovah for this child, I prayed to, and Yehovah has granted me my petition, which I asked of him. Therefore, I have, now this is what I've got in verse 28 in the English, Yoel. Therefore, I have lent him to Yehovah. As long as he lives, he shall be lent to Yehovah. So they worshipped Yehovah there. Is that, have you got lent? Just remind me what you've got in verse 28.
Yeah, that's one of the ones I have.
Yeah, really? Okay. So it's as if they're... But is the connotation to sort of borrow it, that Yehovah is borrowing Shmuel, because he's there for life, right? He's in service for life.
Yeah, he's in service for life. So why does he say borrow? It's an interesting question. So it's I actually looked this up. I couldn't find something clear enough to explain this. I mean, it's a good question. But it still goes into the issue of... she borrowed him from God, not him.
Yeah, because
borrowing him to God. So it's a good question. I'm not 100% sure why she uses terminology, because when we go into the actual prayer, where is it? No, when you actually go to when she names him, she says, "For I borrowed him from God, I borrowed him from the Lord." And it's you know, why is she reversing it now?
Yeah, it's interesting.
And it could be because she's in pain. She could be that she's standing there and she's saying, "Well, you know, after the child, she has to give him away," and she's basically standing there and she's saying, "You know, I'm giving him to God."
Mm.
She's basically. I don't think she's regretting what she's done, but she's hesitating here. She might be having that, betrothal.
That has to
she
be
might
understood.
Not be. I am not too sure, but it
think,
could be that
you would think that she would. Really, I think that's fair to say. And but obviously she's going to see him at least 1 week of the year at least. But still, I mean that's it's got to be a painful thing to leave your beautiful baby boy that you've weaned and taken him to. But also in gratitude, and they do worship Yehovah there as they do that.
It could be that this is a mechanism of showing the emotions. I mean, there's a lot of emotions going on here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you read this in Hebrew, I mean, you probably can see this on in English, but when you read this, you see a lot of emotion going on here, the feelings, and Elkanah's been very, very sympathetic the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
He's always like, he's very passive. He walks up to him and he says, "Why are you sad?" And this is the only place where you actually see him a bit more active, where he says to him, "I'm better to you than the seven sons."
Yeah.
But he's very passive when it comes to when she shows what she's feeling. He's very passive and very understanding. And here again, so that's one mechanism. And then here it's using the same words, because she says "Kishkim kima Adonai she'altiv," and then it says here "Hish'altiv la Adonai." So it's reversed. It's reversing the verb that's used in verse 20. So in verse 28, it reverses the verse. It reverses the verb, and you see the emotion sprouting out here and what she's feeling. And she's standing there. She's saying, "Well, really, he's actually mine, but I'm giving him away because I made a vow. But he's not being given to me, and I'm giving him back. He's mine, and I'm giving him away now." And this is probably part of the emotion that's going on here. It's difficult. Perhaps. You know, you wait for a child for a very, very long time, and then you have to give him away, and it's difficult.
I was going to say, he's 2 or 3 years old, and it's understandable. And so here we are, Yoel. We can't stop here. We have to keep going because, you know, we've got, 15 minutes odd, but we have to do this because this really does sort of sum up the at least this part of the story, this opening, and it's Hannah's prayer in chapter 2 all the way through to from verse 1 to verse 10.
And so much is lost in translation. Seriously.
Truly. Well, let me
so
begin.
So much
because
lost
it starts,
in translation.
Starts like this, that Hannah prayed and she said, "My heart rejoices in Yehovah, my horn." I've got my horn in English. "My horn is exalted in Yehovah. I smile at my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation."
So in Hebrew, it actually says, "Alatz libi ba'adonai, ramak karni ba'adonai, rahav pi al oyevai ki samachti bishuatecha." And first of all, the structure here, there's a lot I can say about songs and how they're structured. But Ramak Karni, so you're saying your horn. So Karni is not necessarily a horn. It's the Keren, the word Keren or horn usually represented strength, power, might, reputation, stuff like that. So Ramak Karni is my persona, my self-image has grown because of what's happened here by God. But then she says in the second half of this verse, and she says, "Rachav pi al oyevai," my mouth has widened on my enemies.
Really?
And she's basically saying, what was in widened? I have the ability to answer now. I can talk back to my enemies. Now she might be hinting to Penina.
Yeah, so when I read that, I got the impression, I did get the impression that she's smiling at her enemies, that she is referring to Peninnah, but it's not absolutely crystal clear. But it goes on to say, no, in verse 2, "No one is holy like Yehovah, for there is none besides you, nor is there any rock like our God."
So he uses the word tzur, and I kind of find it funny, because the word tzur, I was actually asked on Facebook, what do I think of combinations of tzur and tzuria and stuff like that. And so tzur is a rock, and we actually, today modern Hebrew, use the word tzur for flint, so it's a very hard rock. But tzur really just means a rock, a stern rock. And she says, so you can say the first verse is, an opening of the rejoicement. My heart rejoices in the Lord. My horn has been risen, and my mouth has widened up, and everything. She's giving like an introduction to why to her emotion, and now she says praise. Yeah, she says the praise itself, and she says, there's no en kadosh ka Adonai. There's no one holy as God. And by the way, I think this is one of the very first places where we have this concept of kedosh Yisrael. That the God is referred as Kadosh, Mm-hmm. And the other place that we have this is, for example, in Leviticus, where it says, "Kedoshim tioki kadosh ani Adonai Elohechem, be holy for I am holy." And it's very interesting. She says kadosh. Why didn't she say glorious or wonderful or mighty? Why did she say kadosh? And maybe it's in reference because she's talking about that it was answered in the temple or something like that, in a holy place. So this is maybe why it is. Maybe the term kadosh means just beyond the concept of holy. Maybe kadosh means something else that I'm not aware of. And then she says, there's no one like you.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe the concept of someone being holy or something being holy gives it power. Maybe. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And then she says, there's no one like you, and there's no rock like our God.
Mm.
So she's saying three words of praise.
The end of Deuteronomy, right?
Yeah, Tzul, yeah.
Mm.
The word Tzul appears in the end of the book of Deuteronomy in chapter 32. Hatzul tamim po'alo ki kol derecha mishpat. Actually, the Torah kind of says you have to memorize that, and I started working on memorizing that chapter.
The Song of Moses. I'll admit to you, I don't know it off by heart yet. So
neither do I. I'm just saying there are verses here. I mean, usually with this thing, because it's a very catchy song, by the way. It's actually one of the easier ones to memorize. But you should know, when I was, I think I mentioned this when we were doing Judges, is when I was in, was it fourth grade, I had to learn the chapter 5 of Judges, the Song of Devorah.
Oh, really?
I had to memorize it. And it was everyone had to do that. It was hilarious. Everyone had to memorize it. So the chapter 32 in Deuteronomy is actually easier to memorize because it also has a rhythm. The rhythm is easier there.
Interesting. Now listen, this is verse 3, and again, when I read verse 3, Yoel, I did think of Peninnah. Talk no more so very proudly, let no arrogance come from your mouth, for Yehovah is the God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed. Do you reckon that's directed to her, possibly?
So she's using the second person plural.
Mm-hmm.
So tedabro, which means you plural, mm-hmm. It can also be for masculine and feminine, essentially, because it's actually in biblical Hebrew, it's very rare that a second person feminine plural would appear with its distinct form. So she's talking in the second person. So but she's in plural, so she's maybe trying to not say directly about Peninnah. She's kind of going around it. She doesn't want to be mean to her like this. But it can also be that she's talking in general about people in general, people who don't believe in God. She might be saying, look, I'm a testimony that the God of Israel exists and he did this miracle. I was with no children and now I have a child.
Yep, sure.
But one of the reasons people think that she might be talking about Peninnah is because of verse five.
She who has many children. Well, let me read through to verse 5. So 4 says, the bows of the mighty men are broken, and those who stumbled are girded with strength. Those who are
Reminds me of Isaiah. This verse reminds me of a verse in Isaiah. Yomar v'yomar chalash gibor ani ki chatu. There's another verse that says ki chatu keshet giborim. There's actually a verse. Yeah, I think in Isaiah it's almost identical to this one.
Okay.
So, and those who chatu, and here it's keshet giborim chatim. So it's very similar.
Okay. And those in verse 5, those who were full have hired themselves out for bread, and the hungry have ceased to hunger. Even the barren has borne 7 sons. This is verse 5, and she who has many children has become feeble. And so, 7 sons, right? Completeness.
So she's pointing out basically that things can be reversed. This is the main point of what she's saying here. She's using several metaphors here. Who are filled with bread, people who are filled now have to work for bread, which is the lowest level of poverty.
Mm.
You know, I remember seeing a picture of a man standing with a sign saying, we'll work for food. That's the lowest you get, not even money. Mm. I'll work, just give me something to eat.
The hungry have ceased to hunger. Yeah.
And Adakaraya Dashivan, a barren woman gives birth to 7, completeness. 7 always means, it can also be 10, 15, it's just an issue of, or even 3, it's just an issue of it happening.
Mm.
And the woman has many children is sad. Why? Because she probably loses them. And the There's even a midrash, if I remember correctly, this was something I learned years ago. I think there's a midrash that says that because of, we look at Pina being mean to Chana, some people say that there's a midrash that says that she actually lost some of her children because of what she did. Mm. Because the issue of an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, that God actually works on the level of you do something, you get the exact parallel of what you did, you get back. There's even a verse.
I was just going to say it goes with the next verse, really, in verse 6. Yehovah kills and makes alive. He brings down to the grave and brings up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that, actually, there's a term. I think it's called the talion or something like that. The thing for an eye for an eye, tooth for tooth. It's a Roman term. It's a Latin term. But I think it's called a talion or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember exactly. Don't take my word for it.
So another one. Yehovah makes poor and makes rich. He brings low and lifts up. He raises the poor from the dust and lifts the beggar from the ash heap. That reminds me of Job. To set them among princes and make them inherit the throne of glory.
Oh, so the verse 8, Mekim afar dal mashpot yarim evion, there's actually in the book of Psalms, Mekimim afar dal mashpot yarim evion. There's actually almost exact quote, and there's actually two verses here, verse 8 and the end of verse 10, which have identical parallels in the book of Psalms. So let me just find
113.
It's actually what we call the Hallel, which is the special thing we read out on certain feasts.
Here it is. He raises the poor out of the dust and lifts the needy out of the ash heap, that he may set him with princes, with the princes of his people. So that's Psalm 113.
Verse 7 and 8.
Oh, and then Yoel, let's go on. He grants the barren woman a home like a joyful mother of children. Praise Yehovah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's cool.
Exactly. So it's a parallel. And there's a lot. There's a debate regarding who really did she really sing this song in the temple? Was this put in her mouth? And did she say something slightly different? But it's very, very clear that there was a tradition, a psalm tradition that people might have, or a pattern that people were using as part of their praise.
Mm. Yeah, certainly.
So it's not. She made this up. She might have been using some kind of a pattern or. Something distinct that was used for specific praises. It might have been almost like a sidur at the time, that there was specific prayers you would say at specific times. And this is not abnormal in the ancient world. I have access, thank God I have access to a lot of ancient writings, and you see that, where a time of this you say such and such prayer, and a time of this you say such and such prayer. So it could be that this is a prayer. This wasn't something that she made up. This was something that was dictated, that you're supposed to say when you rejoice about a certain issue.
Sure, quite possibly. So it goes on, for the pillars of the earth are Yehovah's. He has set up the world upon them. He will guard the feet of his saints, but the wicked shall be silent in darkness. For by strength no man shall prevail. The adversaries of Yehovah shall be broken in pieces. From heaven he will thunder against them. Yehovah will judge the ends of the earth. Now, it's the last two lines that I want to ask you about, Yoel.
So just a second. I'm looking at the way you translated. So can you read the beginning of verse 10 again? I want to see how they translated it.
Let me go from one line before. It says, for by strength no man shall prevail. The adversaries of Yehovah shall be broken in pieces. What do you got?
So the name of God, it actually says, Adonai yechatu merivav alav b'shamayim yare'im. So this is the name of God, because it's moved into the beginning of the sentence.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of being in the more intermediate, it should have been Merive Hashem Yechatu. So this is might be actually more of as if she raised her voice when she said this, because it's put in the beginning of the sentence, which is emphasis.
Oh,
so it's actually
really?
she might have actually said out the name of God out loud and then continue. It says. And she might have said, Adonai yichatu merivav alav hashamayim yareim. That might have been the way she actually read it. And I'm looking at the cantillations as well. Yeah, it's actually the cantillation is also when you read it, it goes up.
Interesting.
So it's an issue of raising your voice.
So perhaps in the English, Yoel, if I understand you correctly, perhaps here they might have employed an exclamation mark.
They should have put an exclamation. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
They should have put an exclamation mark. Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. So she exclaims the name and says the adversaries of Yehovah shall be broken in pieces from head. Now this is okay. So the last part of verse 10. This is where we're going to end it. And I've got a question here. He will give strength to his king and exalt the horn of his anointed. That's what I've got in the English. What do you have in the Hebrew?
Ve'iten oz le'malko, ve'yarim keren meshicho, and you give might to his king and raise the horn of his anointed one. Same thing.
Which the word is?
Meshicho.
Meshicho. So the Mashiach.
It's the same word as Mashiach, yeah.
That's where we get. Now, is this, because there is no king at this stage, right?
Not yet.
But it's talking about his king. And we hear later in Shmuel that Yehovah says they have rejected me as king. But here it says, and exalt the horn of his, God's king.
You have to first of all ask the first question of king. Now, where's the king?
Where's the king?
So this is why I said this is probably a pattern of prayer and not something she made up on the spot. And when this was copied down, when it was written down, someone continued the prayer because it might have stopped at just before this section, mm-hmm. and they added this after a king was elected. So this might be a very specific prayer that had to be said at a very specific time, was written by someone, and was given out as being, this is what you say when you want to thank for something mm-hmm. specific. Mm-hmm. And this is why it mentions the whole issue of the children. And it's a prayer of reversal. The reality was reversed. And then when this prayer was written, or rewritten again, because they wanted to add a prayer for the king, it was a big change in the world for them. You know, having a king was like a reality of now it's like a child that leaves his parents' house and now he has his own apartment, kind of.
Right.
So the child now has kind of like 2 feet on the ground. He has you know, something that he can stand for, something that he can say, this is mine, I have my property. It's the same thing here. The moment you have a king, you have a leadership, you have a kingdom. Oh, now we're really established. Mm-hmm. And that's actually one of the struggles in the book of Samuel. Because on one hand, the book of Samuel is saying king, bad, bad, bad. And then on the other hand, it's saying king, good, good, good. And you can see that interior struggle. And that struggle continues, I believe, all the way to this very day.
I would agree. There is a struggle, and Hani and I we were talking about this last night because we've been kind of. In fact, you and I recently were talking about King Henry VIII, and
I'm the eighth. I am Henry the eighth. I am. I am. Yeah.
and you know the tyrant and the dictator that he was. And then it got us thinking, what was it about Israel that looked at the nations and thought, we want to be like that? There was obviously something that was appealing about that. And we obviously will get a time to tackle that as we move through Shmuel. But it is interesting. I mean, do you think also, is it possible, Yoel, that in this last few sentences of last few lines of verse 10, is it plausible that she may have been speaking prophetically of Saul and David?
So two things. First of all, regarding the first thing you mentioned, it's like Israelis today, you ask Israelis, they always say, well, in America, it's XYZ. You know, who cares what's done in America? America is America. Israel is Israel. Mm-hmm. Two distinct things. But I keep on hearing a lot from people here in Israel about, you know, in America, it's different. Who says? You know, for example, if you were looking at, you know, if you were living in the time and people say, well, in Egypt, they have a king and the Moabites have a king and the Hittites have a king. We just want to be in style. Yeah, those are tyrants. We don't know sure we want those. Mm. And this is, by the way, this is part of the warning that Samuel puts down later on that we'll see it when we get to this. So that's that, you know, that's really, that's the mentality all the time, you know, upstate is nicer. Why? I don't know. We just think it's nicer. The neighbor's grass is greener.
Yeah, that's true. The neighbor's grass is greener. The grass is greener on the other side.
Now, regarding your second question, if you're a traditionalist, there are traditional commentators in Jewish world that basically say, yeah, she was talking out of prophecy. I'm a traditionalist, but here in this one, in this case, because I do understand the concept of editing, mm-hmm. that this was probably either a format that she was using, or this went through editing. There's someone's trying to hint the idea of praise the king, praise the king, praise the king. The Book of Samuel essentially is kind of like, I would say, a pitch for King David and his kingdom and his house.
Sure. Okay. Interesting. Well, there's a different perspective, and one that I hadn't even thought of, Yoel. When I read that, I thought that's very, very interesting. It's certainly curious. I wonder if that is prophetic, and you've given another perspective there. So thank you for that, my friend. And so, of course, verse 11, then Elkanah went to his house of Ramah, but the child ministered to Yehovah before Eli, the priest. And then it goes on. We're going to continue next week from verse 12. It talks about the sons of Eli.
Another issue of leadership. This is where we start dealing with the leadership issue.
Mm.
Next week is going to be a whole discussion about the concept of leadership, the demise of the house of Eli, and what exactly went on there. There's a lot of weird stuff going on in this one as well.
Mm.
The one thing I can say is that the Israelites invented the fork before the Europeans did.
Cool. Okay. Thanks for that.
Week I'll explain.
Keep you on the edge of your seats, listeners, for the explanation for that one. But until then, we've started the Book of Samuel. We're going to be continuing on from chapter 2, verse 12 next week. Until then, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's Word. Hang on, before I go, Yoel, okay. Let me just remind everybody. I just want to remind everyone, Hebrew in Israel. Hebrew in Israel Facebook page. What are you talking about? Hebrew in Israel Facebook page.
So actually, when I use this, I forgot. I've passed the 900 point. I mean,
way!
I'm almost at 1,000. I mean, wow. I mean, I'm completely mind blown.
Everyone has to go to Truth to You and like Truth to You on Facebook, because Yoel's not allowed to have more friends than me. 900, that's great. So thank you to the listeners for liking Hebrew in Israel and engaging with the information there. And I encourage you to do so. And still, now I know you're fully booked. Yoel is Hebrew in Israel. Can people still email you?
There's an official waiting list now. It's pretty surprising. I mean, I'm shocked. I mean, I started the whole teaching Hebrew from Keith Johnson convincing me to do it. I wasn't even convinced I'll be able to do it. I just said, I'll just do it for a while. Maybe it worked. And it's become a full blown business. I mean, private business, small one, but.
Praise you.
And it's really, it's opened up a lot of very interesting things for me. So I actually want to thank here, if we're already doing this touchy-feely thing, I want to thank Keith Johnson for just being a friend. You know, he walked up to me and said, you know, you should teach Hebrew, you know, what you're doing. Hmm. I'm like, I wasn't too sure. So I really want to thank Keith for the push. I really want to thank Nehemiah for answering questions when I wasn't too sure about stuff or when I didn't know, for helping me figure out which books to use, giving me guidelines for everything. Really, Nehemiah, really, really, man, I miss you, man. Come back to Israel, please. Obviously, I want to thank you, Jono, and Truth to You for the platform, for the advertising. Really, I mean, man, you have no idea how much you've helped. Really, you have no idea how much you've helped.
Well, just let me say, it's entirely our privilege to have you on the program, and I know the listeners feel the same way. And you spend explaining things to us in the Hebrew language,
and to the listeners I'll say one very simple thing. I got a message from someone on Facebook saying, "Yoel, you have no idea how much encouragement you give us.
Yeah.
How much you know? How useful this information is." And it helps me continue, because I also know there's a lot of struggles out there with different people, with different groups. I mean, I remember I was walking around with my friend Rico Cortez, and we're walking in middle of Jerusalem, and we bump into this group, and I could see the tension there, because Rico, for example, comes from one kind of stream inside the Hebrew roots, and this person comes from another stream, and you could almost see the sparks in between them, and And, you know, and in many cases, these arguments can be settled by, okay, dude, this is what the Hebrew says. This is how that. And I've noticed that I've helped people figure a lot of things out. And there's a lot of confusion, a lot of opinions and stuff like that. And I've realized that it helps. And this person says, yeah, I have no idea how much you've helped and stuff like that. Mm. And I actually met up with a whole bunch of people. First of all, I met up with Joe Dumont, if you remember him.
Ah, so yeah, because I know Joe was there over Sukkot. So you met up with him.
It was hilarious. I'm waiting for a friend who came from outside of Israel, from Ireland, and I'm waiting to see her. I'm waiting, and I can't get a hold of her. And I'm standing in the middle of the street in Jerusalem, and I actually went especially into Jerusalem. I said, okay, I turned up to the sky and said, listen, God, I came all the way out here. Please help me out. And I look across the street, and I see someone who looks very familiar, but he's kind of distant. So I start walking towards him, and he's standing there with a group of people. And he stared. At one point, he realized someone's looking at him. Now, I've, thank God, lost a lot of weight. And I look at him. He stares back at me. And then suddenly he pushes. I don't know, pushes, but he kind of moves away from the group, walks up to me and says, Yoel! He gives me this huge hug. And I'm talking with people. And people are telling me, yes, of course we know who you are. And of course we know, you know, it's you're from Truth to You. And you've been on Truth to You. And we know, yeah, you're Yoel from Hebrew and Israel. And I'm like, so people actually do know what I'm doing. So I need to start reconsidering the fact that I'm actually doing something. I'm actually affecting something here. So again, to everyone, it's a privilege, and I want to thank everyone out there who's been following this stuff. I say, and if I've offended anyone, I do apologize. You have to remember that I'm relatively new into this, and I'm also Israeli, so we don't cut slack to anyone.
but we have great listeners, don't we? We have really great listeners.
We have great listeners, and really, I mean, it's encouraging. I'm shocked how, I mean, literally, I've had this page for since, I think, I don't know, February or something like that. Hmm. And I mean, we're looking at something like 8 months. I've passed 900. That's more than 100 people a month who do a like on that page. Now, I've lost some people. It happens. But most people stay, and it's really encouraging.
It's encouraging. It's really encouraging. Yeah. So we have really great listeners, and we do appreciate listeners being so encouraged. And all the comments, all the encouraging comments that they send me, it is overwhelming. And g'day to those who were with Joe Damon in Israel over Sukkot. Thanks for listening. Really appreciate you guys as well. So there we are. This is the touchy-feely thing.
Yeah, touchy-feely thing. Oh, every once in a while.
It's always good to do. And but yep, definitely 1 Samuel chapter 2, verse 12 and on next week, dear listeners. Speak to you then.
We'll speak to you then. And I hope these teachings help everyone. And so don't forget, supporttruthtoyou.org.
Support Truth to You. So if support these programs, you. If they've been a blessing to you, you can certainly support Truth to You by going to Truth to You and donating there. And we really do appreciate your prayers and support as well. We're done. I'm going to go and blow my nose. Okay, shalom.
Shalom.